Welcome to all of you. My name is Jillian Rogan, and I'm a member of Independent Jewish Voices Hamilton. And I'm really honored to be facilitating this event for us this evening. And I'm even more honored to be introducing to you Jeff Helfer, who to many of you needs no introduction. Many of us here have been following his work for decades. Jeff Helfer is an Israeli anthropologist, the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and a founding member of the One Democratic State campaign. He's the author of several books, including his most recent book that forms the basis of his talk this evening, and it's called Decolonizing Israel, Liberating Palestine, Zionism, Settler Colonialism, and the Case for the One Democratic State. And it's for sale out there, and I wonder if Jeff might consider signing copies for the first time afterwards. For decades, Jeff has been a leading voice for peace and justice, and his scholarship and activism informed so much of the Global Solidarity for Palestine movement. I worked with Jeff at ICAD in East and West Jerusalem in 2006, where he became a mentor and a friend. I learned an immense amount from him about civil disobedience, and that training actually came in quite handy that summer. And activism, strategy, the history and politics of Israel and Palestine. And whether just walking around Jerusalem, whether we were in organizing meetings, or sitting around the dinner table, his knowledge and wisdom that he imparted are unforgettable to me, and have informed my work as a scholar and as an activist. But not only has he invested decades of life into Palestine solidarity, but into investing in helping foster generations of activists, both Palestinians, Jews, Arabs, Muslims, Canadians, internationals. Many of us have benefited from his work. He does this kind of mentorship with humility and grace, and with a resolve that demonstrates a radical commitment to hope and justice and for an end to settler colonization. All of us here tonight from IJV believe deeply in struggles to decolonize, and we work towards the liberation of indigenous peoples everywhere. So the land that we're currently on belongs to the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe people, including the Erie, Neutral, Huron-Wendat, and the Mississaugas. The land is governed by the Dish With One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, which is an agreement between the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe people to care and share for the resources around the Great Lakes. Land acknowledgments are commitments to land back, to reparations and to justice, and it is with this acknowledgement that I commit to those things in practice here in so-called Canada, as well as in Palestine. IJV supports decolonization in all of its manifestations. We're all at this moment bearing witness to genocide being committed against Palestinians in Gaza. We're witnessing an escalation of violence against Palestinians in the West Bank and an escalation of violence in the entire region. The atrocities being committed are not being committed by Israel alone, but also by the countries who have provided material support and permission, including Canada. When I was in Palestine with Jeff, the settler colonial apartheid violence that I witnessed allowed me to understand Canadian settler colonization in a deeper way. And when I traveled to Saskatchewan with my friend and colleague Sylvia McAdam, I learned about Palestine as she took me on the tours of her land and showed me the erasures, the narratives, the graves of children. I invite all of us to allow in that interconnectedness as we hear Jeff speak, because we can't talk about decolonization of Palestine without talking about it here, and not just talking about it, committing to decolonizing. So Jeff will speak for about 45 minutes, and then we'll invite a student activist to come and be a discussant for him and ask him some questions, some maybe probing questions. And then we'll have a question and answer period. And at that point, I'll sort of lay the framework for the Q&A. While Jeff and the student are speaking, I hope that we can all hold our questions and comments until the very end so that we don't have any disruptions. And also, just wanted to point your attention that there's an email sign-up sheet if you want to be included in emails about IJB or any of the other co-sponsors for the event. You can sign up on a sheet, or you can fill out an index card if you don't want your email to be seen publicly, and make sure an usher or someone at the desk has that card. And there's QR codes. There's a QR code that links to all of the groups who are sponsoring tonight's event. So on the QR code, I think you can check some of the boxes and descending order of which groups you want to be in touch with. Okay, so with that, I'll hand it over to Jeff.
Well, thank you very much for that. And I mean, it's always wonderful to see, you know, people, I don't know, mentor is the right word. That's a little patronizing. But, you know, people that you worked with when they were young and you were a little younger, you know, really stepping out and continuing the work in all kinds of areas. So that's meaningful for me. I want to just start, you know, with my own two acknowledgments that I think are important. One is, you know, of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. You know, tonight we'll be talking about politics, the future, ideas of how to resolve this whole thing, some theory, all kind, you know. And I've had people say to me, that's inappropriate. It's inappropriate to talk about this sort of stuff while a genocide is going on. So I want to make it clear that we're not by any means ignoring or neglecting the genocide. That should be in our hearts and in our thoughts and so on. But at the same time, we have to multitask. You know, as terrible, that's not the right word, as the genocide is, you know, it's the ultimate crime. It's very hard to find the ultimate adjective for what describes it. Politically speaking, in geopolitical terms, it's not the major event. It's actually a very marginal sort of a thing. And it's a hiccup in a much bigger geopolitical process that's going on that we really have to be sensitive to. And that is the whole normalization process between Israel and at least the pro-Western Arab world, from Jordan, through Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, Egypt, Morocco, and so on. We have to remember that, you know, a couple of weeks before October 7th, Biden, at the G7 meeting in Europe, unveiled the IMAP, the India-Middle East Corridor, IMEC, and this was a corridor. It was going to go from India, or it's still planned to go from India through the Middle East into Israel, where Haifa port becomes the hub of this whole network, and the hub between India, the Middle East, and Europe. And then it goes down from Haifa into Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and so on. So first of all, it's really a way to cement Israel's geopolitical centrality to the whole region. But at the same time, of course, it's the counterweight to the Chinese Road and Belt Initiative. So the bigger geopolitics are, the United States wanting to pivot away from the Middle East towards China, but it needs a surrogate. And so there's open talking about a Middle East NATO. And the Middle East NATO would be built upon Israel, which is the only country that has the military power and prowess to anchor that kind of a military alliance with, of course, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So those would be the three major pillars. So, you know, we live and this is something I'm not going to talk about tonight, but it's something that's important that we should be kind of, you know, dealing with a little bit more. We live in a transactional world. Our governments and the international system is absolutely transactional. There's no such thing, even though Biden talks about a rules-based international order, and we have civil rights and human rights and international law and concepts like justice and liberation and equality and whatever, those are all laughable concepts for governments. They play no role whatsoever. It is all transactional. Everything is a deal. Everything is interests, it's power plays, it's utilizing your resources and your interests to make allies with others. Everything is short term. There's no grand strategy, and there's certainly no grand strategy towards global justice in any kind of a way. So there's a real disconnect between our governments and us, because we, the people, are motivated by those kinds of values, you see? And in a way, we sort of expect our governments, even though we know our government, but we kind of expect them somehow to listen to us or somehow to reflect, you know, our views, our will, and so on, and somehow that would get into foreign policy. But it doesn't in any way. Even when they pretend to listen to us, it's transactional in order to get reelected. You see, and so in that kind of a transactional world, Israel is right at the table. I mean, Israel has a lot to offer at the table with the big boys. Military prowess, surveillance technologies, technologies of repression for police forces, for repressive regimes all over the world, a geopolitical, geographical place, you know, in the Middle East and in the region between Africa, the Middle East, and Europe, that's really crucial. And so, Israel's important. What do the Palestinians offer? The Palestinians are absolutely marginal to this whole system. What do they bring to the table? They don't have resources. They don't have any military strength. They don't control the strategic political place where they are. You see, so in a transitional world, they're lost. They're gone. And that's what's facing us with this process of normalization. That Biden has said that as soon as the fighting dies down in Gaza, because Gaza was that hiccup. So here Biden at the G7 is announcing the IMEC project. A week later at the UN, if you remember, Netanyahu was standing on the podium of the General Assembly, holding up the map of Israel, but of the greater Israel, Israel between the river and the sea, right? And saying, this is the centerpiece of the new Middle East, and in a week, we'll be signing a normalization agreement with Saudi Arabia. And I really think that that was part of the timing of October 7th, because October 7th, the Hamas attack, stop that. Now, I don't know if it stopped it in its tracks completely, because they're still determined to go back to it. The Palestinians are too marginal to really hold up forever these bigger geopolitical projects. But they did stop it for a while. And I think that was part of the timing of the attack on October 7th. The point is, they're coming back to it now. And so, Gaza, even though it has to be at the center of our attention, can't be the only center of attention. We've got to be able to also, at the same time, kind of free ourselves to look at this bigger geopolitical project in which the West Bank and what's happening there actually is more significant than what's happening in Gaza, in geopolitical terms, not necessarily in the terms of human suffering and destruction and so on. So that's really what's awaiting us. By Israel, we mean Israel on 78% of the country, plus the major settlement blocks that are, on good parts of the West Bank. And now this week, the Israeli government, Smotrich, Bezalel Smotrich, who's this crazy, violent right-wing settler, who's been arrested many times for terrorism, actually, who is now not only the finance minister of Israel, but he is the head of the civil administration, which is the Israeli military government of the West Bank that has all the authority to expropriate lands, to build settlements, to demolish Palestinian homes. And he has announced, and this is coming down the pipeline, that Area B of the West Bank is now going to be annexed to Area C. Area C is the 62% of the West Bank that's under complete Israeli control. And that's where the settlements are, about 750,000 settlers. And that's where the ethnic cleansing is going on today, where settlers are being brought into the Israeli army and released in a violent way to drive Palestinians off their lands and out of their villages. Area B is another 22% of the West Bank. And that's where half the Palestinian population lives. So when we're thinking of Israeli apartheid, even the UN talks about there is an apartheid regime today. Israel plus the occupied territories is an apartheid regime. We've always thought in terms of, there'll be a fakey two-state solution. That's what Biden is all about. Biden's not going to say legitimize apartheid. So it'll be the Bantustan, exactly the South African mode, will be considered a state, right? And then we have a two-state solution. But with the annexation of Area B, we're talking about an Israel on more than 90% of historic Palestine. The Palestinians are today the majority of the country. They're about 51 or so percent of the population. Will be reduced to, Area A is 18% of the occupied territory. In other words, 18% of 22% of historic Palestine, and that divided into all kinds of little tiny islands, plus Gaza, which is uninhabitable. So we're going to talk about an apartheid system worse than that of South Africa. I mean, if you can get a worse apartheid regime, from the point of view that this massive population will be shoved into these little tiny enclaves of Area A and Gaza, which means it can't contain them all, which means that a good proportion of those 2 million or so people are going to have to leave the country. And then with the plans to empty out Gaza, largely through humanitarian gestures, where Canada will take tens of thousands of refugees, the U.S. will take, Australia will take, you're really looking at a process of ethnic cleansing, a process of genocide, not only in Gaza, but throughout the country. And we're looking at a process in which apartheid will be legitimized by your government and by all governments. Israel expands between the river and the sea. The Palestinians are eliminated as any kind of political force, and normalization happens with Saudi Arabia and the rest and the pro-Western Arab world, and that's it. It's over. So what I'm trying to say, way too long, because I don't want to, because I have more to say, and that is that that's why we have to multitask. That's why we have to acknowledge Gaza, and really acknowledge what's happening, the genocide there, but at the same time, we have to keep this wider perspective of what's happening politically, because politically, the real name of the game is not in Gaza, it's in the West Bank and this normalization process. The second acknowledgement I want to make is that I'm a settler. That's very important. Just like your acknowledgement, which, is something that this is a settler country. I also have to acknowledge that not only for myself, but as a precondition, really, for working with Palestinians and for, you know, being able to be a comrade in the struggle. And I call myself, and I say it in the book, a settler who refuses, or a colonizer who refuses. In other words, it's not only the acknowledgement, but the refusal part is the political actions that I try to take in order to decolonize the colonial regime. So that, you know, those two things are important. So what I want to do tonight is talk to you about our ideas. Now, I'm the head of ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, for many years. And Jillian was with us in our office. But I'm also a part of a Palestinian-led organization that's called the One Democratic State Campaign. And we're really looking for how do you resolve this. In other words, resistance is crucial. Protests you do is important. BDS is important. Education, lobbying. But in the end, there has to be a political program. There has to be a political resolution. And if you're in a political struggle, as the Palestinians are, without a political program, you're lost. You're not in the game. There's a vacuum here. It's like we're all sitting around the table, and Israel knows exactly what it wants and where it's going. And the United States has its agenda, and the G7 have their agendas, and the Arab world has its agenda, and you come around the table, and the Palestinian chair is empty. There's no one there, and there's no one speaking. And so we're trying, in this One Democratic State campaign, to fill that seat, or to insert the political plan. It's still in the early stages, and we'll talk about it. There's still a lot of some disagreements. But anyway, I want to kind of share that with you. But on the way, all right, but a political plan just isn't like, okay, here's a plan, let's think of 10 points. And a political program has to emerge from your analysis. In other words, if you go to the doctor with a pain in your chest, you know, I mean, the doctor has 100 pills on the shelf. He can just pick one out and give it to you and send you on your way. But whether you're having a stroke or whether you're having an acid attack and he can just give you a Tums, that's kind of an important part of the interaction, the diagnosis, because the treatment follows the diagnosis. And that's, I think, where we are. The two-state solution we've talked about all these years that governments still support, as we'll see in a minute, is a treatment that has nothing, that's based on a misdiagnosis. It has nothing to do with the disease whatsoever. It's a Tums for a stroke. And therefore, you know, so what I want to do before we get into the one-state idea, the political program, is to go back and talk about settler colonialism. Because this is a settler colonial, it's not a conflict, as we'll say, it's a settler colonial enterprise that's going on. Now, it's interesting because, you know, academic terms are often kept within the rarefied atmosphere of the academy. You know, all their jargon very seldom gets out to the general public. But settler colonialism, which is quite a mouthful, has somehow escaped. And it's gotten into the general discourse. I mean, everybody talks about settler colonialism, Israel settler colonial, but the concept, as super important as it is not understood by the general public. It's used more as an accusation. You know, Zionism instead of colonialism, okay, got that out of the way, now let's talk about, you know, whatever. But you can't just get it out of the way. It has to be the basis of how we understand what's going on, because the only way out of settler colonialism is decolonization. So we've got to get a plan that's based on decolonization. So what I'd like to do is take a few minutes and just go through what settler colonialism means. I mean, it's still going to be fairly superficial, but at least we'll unpack some of it And then you'll see how it feeds into the political program. I don't know, we have two screens and one B. All right, maybe I'll try to stay in the center, okay? That's what I tend to roam, so that's why they gave me another. I'm not supposed to touch your mic. Okay. So, let's start in this way. We need a paradigm shift, because we're always talking about conflict. Even the Palestinians talk about the conflict. You know, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But the terms we use are really important, because the terms we use lock us into one way of analyzing or another way of analyzing. A conflict is when you get two or more sides, there's a dispute, there's a fight between two or more sides, and there's a conflict, right? Well, the minute you say sides, the minute you make Zionism and Israel a side, you've already legitimized it. You've already done all of Israel's work. Because we can't justify and legitimize colonialism in any form. We'll talk about it. It's violent, it's an invasion, it's based on genocide and so on. It can't in any way be legitimized. But as soon as we frame it as a conflict, now it is, because it becomes a side. And not only that, but it creates a false symmetry. Now we're always talking, you hear this all the time, both sides. Both sides should end the conflict. Both sides should negotiate. Both sides should end the violence. Right? And now we've got a symmetry between the colonizers and the colonized. In addition to that, how do you resolve a conflict? You know, there's conflict resolution. In conflict resolution, you know, the sides get together. And often they have, you know, they have these new kinds of techniques like Camp David, you know. They all get together, they're in a camp out in the woods, you know, they're having coffee together, they're eating together, building trust between the colonizers and the colonized. And then you negotiate and compromise. Well, that puts the colonized in a completely impossible position. What are the Palestinians supposed to compromise on in order to be, remember in Camp David with Barak towards the end, 1999, he accused the Palestinians, he offered a generous offer, the Palestinians refused, and then he and Clinton accused them of being unreasonable, intractable, you know, because they were refusing a completely generous, compromise. But what does that mean? What are we asking the colonized to do? Are the Palestinians supposed to say, okay, 78% of our country is now somebody else's country? It was conquered by colonists. We've been displaced, and now we have to be reasonable to accept that as a fact? Is that what they're being forced to compromise? Have they been forced to compromise on refugees? There's 7 million refugees. Well, Israel's not going to accept them, obviously. So now we have to begin to bicker on, well, they accept 150,000? Well, maybe, okay, let's talk about 100,000. In other words, you're starting to bargain with people's lives. And not only that, but refugees have a right to return. And you know, in international law, you're forbidden to abrogate your own human rights. So the very fact that a conflict resolution process forces the Palestinians to negotiate refugees, even the fact that they're forced into that kind of a negotiation, they're abrogating their own human rights. They have no right to give up their rights, give up the right of return for refugees. You see? what are we supposed to compromise on? That we can be erased from the country as Palestinians. In other words, the very idea of any kind of compromise is really, it contributes to the elimination and even the genocide of the indigenous population. So conflict is not the way we want to go. It doesn't show any way out that's just. So instead of conflict, we should be talking in anti-colonial terms. We're in an anti-colonial struggle against Zionist settler colonialism. That is the name of the game. That's the diagnosis, right? Now, if you can understand that, it's not easy to accept. Even the language is difficult, and it's threatening for sometimes for Jews and so on. We're not saying Jews don't have a link to the country. I mean, I live there, so there's a subcontext, a subtext here. You know, it's not saying that Jews are like a British farmer that gets up one morning and goes to Kenya to get cheap land. I mean, there is a genuine tie between Jews and the land of Israel. I mean, Jews have moved there for years, have immigrated, have done pilgrimage for years there, of course. But the Jews that have always come there before Zionism came as pilgrims or immigrants. They came to fulfill their religious lives. They felt, there was a cultural expression there. They wanted to live in Jerusalem or Tiberias or Hebron or whatever. But they lived with the local population. They never came with the intention of taking over. There was no hostile attempt. They were fulfilling their lives within the context of the society, and they were welcomed. Jews were always welcomed in the Ottoman Empire in general, but in Palestine in particular. So when we say settler colonialism and we're against Zionism, it isn't saying that Jews are like the British settler that gets up. They have no. No. What we're saying is, even though Jews want to come out of a genuine sense of a connection to the country, they cannot come as settlers. You can come as immigrants, but you can't, nothing justifies a settler colonial movement. Even if you use Judaism and the Bible and all of that as a justification, once it takes the form of settler colonialism, which means genocide, ethnic cleansing, displacement of the local population, it's illegitimate and immoral. So that the fact that we adopt these, even though it sounds hostile towards Jews, and it isn't, it's simply saying, you can stay in the land, you can come to the land, but you can't come as colonists. And that's really the name of the game, which means then that there's no negotiated solution. You can't negotiate again these things that are non-negotiable. The only way out of settler colonialism is decolonization. You have to dismantle and decolonize the settler colonial project, the state, dismantle all the structures of control and domination that have been erected, right? And then you begin to get a more of a level playing field that then allows you, after decolonization, to begin to forge a new political and social order. But it's new. In other words, as long as the colonial framework exists, there's no way you can reform it. There's no way you can carve out some Palestinian space with it. You've got to end that. You have to dismantle the colonial framework in order to get to a situation where genuinely you can begin to build something new. Now, in settler colonialism, just to go on for another minute or two, the settler colonial movement always invents a narrative of why the land belongs to the settlers rather than to the indigenous population. Why we're entitled to that land. And that narrative is important not only to justify, the elimination of the native population, but for your own justification. You're a normal person. You know, Ma and Pa and the kids in the covered wagon going west. I mean, they certainly don't want to see themselves as criminals. Bad people that... So they envelop themselves in this narrative that justifies it. It often has to do with God. You know, that's one of the good ways to do it. Because who's going to argue with that? I don't know about Canada. I don't know if you have a term. But in the United States, it was manifest destiny. You know, that God intended for the Europeans to take possession of, you know, and all the American, you know, hymns, you know, God shed his grace on thee, and all, I mean, it's until today, that's kind of that's the way it's looked at. You know, in South Africa, it was the Dutch Reformed Church that interpreted the Bible to say South Africa belongs to the white man because of God. The Catholic Church had their doctrine of discovery that allowed them to colonize half the world, you know, and justify it, and justify the genocide against the local populations. Well, Zionism has a ready-made narrative. Well, we've got the Bible, you know, and not only that, but it's not the Bible the way you think of it. It's the five books of Moses and the book of Joshua in particular. If you ever want to read the definitive work on genocide, it's the book of Joshua. God is absolutely genocidal. You kill, this is an order. You kill every single man, woman, child, ass, donkey, cow, dog, everything that lives in the entire country of Canaan. You know, you kill them, and this is God's command. And I don't know if you know the book of Joshua, but there's one guy named Achan. Achan, who, you know, and because you don't only kill everything, but then you loot all the goods of the Canaanites and you sacrifice them to the Lord. Right? Okay. Well, Achan takes a cup. You know, he has it, and God finds out about it. You know, that he stole a cup from God. Right? And he says to Joshua, burn him. I mean, go home and read the book of Joshua. And Achan says, I'm sorry, geez, I didn't mean it, you know. They burned the guy. I mean, there's no compassion here. There's zero toleration. And that is simply a later reflection of what you get all through the first five books of Moses. They're genocidal works. And so not only is genocide, as we'll say in a minute, built into settler colonialism in general, but it's specifically and divinely ordered in Zionism that bases itself on the Bible, even though the Zionists were not religious. I know. The French didn't like religion, so they had their civilizing mission towards the savages. Whatever the narrative was, it was a narrative that entitled you then to invade the country. Settler colonialism is an invasion. Now, it's not always like Normandy. It's not always seen as that. I mean, it took the Palestinians about 20 years from the 1880s towards the turn of the century before they began to perceive that these small groups of Jews that were just trickling in and going to live in kind of marginal areas, in fact, were a part of a very well-financed, well-conceived project to take over their country. It took them a while. Yeah, here too, I don't know how, you know, if you have the pilgrim story of Thanksgiving, the Native Americans welcomed the pilgrims. We all know that story before they were exterminated by the same pilgrims. So it's not always perceived as an invasion, but it is an invasion, even if it takes time. So the country is invaded in order to remake the country in your own image. This is the genocidal part. You don't only get rid of the people, you get rid of every trace of their cultural heritage in the country. You erase physically their presence from the country. We'll come back to that in a minute. The term that's most appropriate for capturing this in terms of Palestine is Judaization. It's not a term we use very often. You know, unlike occupation, apartheid, even conflict, it doesn't have a legal reference. There's no law against Judaization, you know? And it sounds vaguely anti-Semitic, so people tend to stay away from it. But it is exactly the right term. If this is an anti-colonial struggle, we have to begin to adopt anti-colonial language, right? And Judaization is exactly what Senator Filonis intends, to come into a country and to remake it in your own image, eliminating the local population. We're Judaizing. And that's a term that the Israeli government uses officially in its documents. It isn't just some, you know, accusation or term that I made up or something. We talk, you know, there are, the policy officially of the Israeli government is to Judaize the Galilee. Mm-hmm. We're Judaizing Jerusalem. We're Judaizing the land of Israel. Or you know, so that is a term that we should be using more rather than, you know, I would say even more than apartheid. Because apartheid, you know, kind of, you know, can be kind of built into a two-state solution. In other words, if you end apartheid somehow, you know, that then, but it keeps the possibility of keeping the colonial framework intact somehow, and you somehow just end that piece that's apartheid, you know. So Judaization, I think, is the proper term. Now, settler colonialism then is inherently violent. There is no peaceful settler colonial process. It's unilateral. That's what's important. It's unilateral, so there can't be a conflict. Palestinians never had a fight with Jews. I mean, there was never a conflict. There was never a dispute. It's unilateral. And since it's unilateral then, its intention is, again, to eliminate the indigenous and replace them, and therefore genocide is built in to the settler colonial process, both physical genocide and cultural genocide. So by necessity then, the indigenous must resist. Resistance is a part of the whole thing. And resistance is the proper term. So what's every settler colonial enterprise does is it criminalizes resistance, because it's presenting itself as a normal, peaceful, moral process of settling a country. Usually, you know, so much marginalizing the indigenous that it really isn't a big deal just to kind of push these few people out of the way and so on. But the indigenous have to resist. But in order to delegitimize the resistance, it's criminalized, we all know, as terrorism, in particular, you know, that term. And they're terrorists, right? And so there is no just, and you see this in Gaza. This is one of the bases of the genocide. Israeli cabinet ministers have said there are no innocent civilians in Gaza. They're all terrorists. So it enables you to criminalize. And once you criminalize, you're depoliticizing a situation. Now there is no conflict at all from the settler colonial point of view, because now it reinforces the idea, not only are we entitled, but we're also entitled to fight these terrorists that are trying to attack us. You see, and which is something we have to resist, and therefore we cannot equate indigenous resistance with the violent campaigns of dispossession of the settlers. And that's really important, because, you know, we do use terms like terrorism. We do criminalize, I mean, not we, but, you know, our governments, the media, and so on, and within the conflict of a conflict. And so Israel can present itself as a peaceful, you know, we're offering a generous offer to the Palestinians, and if they turn it down, then obviously they're intractable, and if they start to fight us, then what are they fighting? We're just normal every day. That's the narrative that's coming out of October 7th as well. You know, that all these, and my heart does go out to the hostages and those that were killed, which is true. In some ways, they were innocent. But in another sense, you know, again, by making the Hamas operation a criminal operation, a criminal attack, a terrorist attack, we're taking away from the idea of resistance. And when Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, says October 7th did not happen in a vacuum. In other words, for whatever, you know, crimes or human rights violations were committed and whatever, there was a context to it. So we have to begin to insist on terms like resistance and reject, you know, all the vocabulary that they use, like terrorism. Indigenous resistance can never end, of course. Insecurity is then built in into the entire system. And it's not only, you know, here you can look at Canada as an example. It's not only the physical insecurity that's built in. In Israel, of course, the Palestinians are a large enough population with national aspirations and with military capacity that they genuinely pose a security threat, you know, to Israelis. That's true. But it can be managed. And that's why Israel is still looking towards normalization. But what can't be managed is the presence of the indigenous population. Unless they can be absolutely eliminated in a genocidal way, their presence is always not just threatening, but it's there. In other words, the way you end settler colonialism, I'll talk about in 1 second, is through normalization. You normalize the settler colonial situation, that, like we talked about at the beginning. That ends it. Then it's over. Like in Canada, you should have been able to do that. I mean, you know, the First Nations went through genocide, cultural and physical. They've been marginalized. They're small, tiny groups. You know, Canada is a large nation. It has, you know, the non-native population is overwhelmingly large. So where's the security? Where's the insecurity in all of this? Well, the insecurity is the very presence of the First Nations. You know, because that you can't get to normalization as long as they're there. You know, you can't close that lid on the settler colonial thing as long as residential schools pop up, or, you know, violence pops up in indigenous communities, or the poverty, or, you know, cultural claims to land and resources. They're not threats in the security sense that Israel might be facing with Palestinians, but their threats, and that is certainly what's driving Israel and Gaza. What's happening in Gaza is a cultural genocide. Nothing to do with military. This is the Islamic University in Gaza that was destroyed by the Israeli army. And the commander of the operation said publicly, this had no military justification. This was because the university is a cultural symbol, a cultural hub of the Palestinians, and that's why we destroyed it. Every university's been destroyed, every library, right? Almost every mosque that they could find. And so this is, you see, that expression of cultural genocide because of the insecurity, not military, but the insecurity of the very presence of the indigenous. And I would say that the symbol of settler colonialism in Israel-Palestine is the bulldozer. Because this is what is demolishing homes, demolishing neighborhoods, demolishing universities, demolishing infrastructure, landscapes, farms. This is the machine of erasure. And this is a D9 bulldozer. Now they're automated. And the automated Caterpillar, D9 bulldozer, look how big it is. These are people standing by the shovel. And you see the shovel is constructed in a way, see a normal bulldozer, a Caterpillar bulldozer is used in mining, let's say. Well, if you hit a building with a normal Caterpillar bulldozer, the building will collapse on the driver. So Israeli military engineers with Caterpillar engineers designed a shovel so that when it hits even an apartment building, right, the building falls away from the driver. They're especially designed for the demolition of buildings and farms and infrastructure. So in other words, this isn't like a spontaneous reaction to terrorism. You know, this is thought out. It's thought through, and the engineers are spending years designing shovels. This, from my point of view, is the symbol. More than tanks, more than artillery, more than soldiers, this is the symbol of settler colonialism. And you can see the process. We all know the maps, the Judaization, de-Arabization. And finally, like I said, settler colonialism wins, triumphs when it's normalized, and that's exactly the process that the United States and Canada are trying to usher in now, as we said before. So what do we do about this? All right, that's the diagnosis. Now what's the treatment? It seems so obvious to me, I don't have to even argue it, that the two-state solution is not a treatment that emerges out of the diagnosis. You know, because first of all, it keeps a settler colonial state on 78% of the land that it's conquered and cleansed, but at the same time, it keeps the whole colonial structure intact. Yeah, and tries to carve out some kind of little space for the native population and a couple percentage of the land, you know, as a kind of a compensation or whatever, so that we can eliminate it. You know, simply from the point of view that it does not decolonize. So decolonization, the only approach or peace, or not peace plan, I hate that term, the only political program that's just and will work is one of one state. So one state begins with decolonization. I'm not going to get into that right now, we don't have time, but there's again, dismantling all the structures of control, the political, you know, system, and the government and so on, the legal system, you know, certainly the land regime, that's the heart of the settler colonial regime, taking the land and so on. So you need land redistribution, you need a whole different land regime in a decolonized situation. The economics, it's all been colonized and people have access and people don't have access and all of that. The population management, I mean, there's people here in this audience that cannot, Palestinians that cannot go back to Palestine. So obviously there's the population management is obvious even in this room. And not to mention expulsions and everything else, and the management of legitimacy, which is Hasbara, which is Israeli PR. Well, you know, this all has to be decolonized. And then our proposal is one democratic state. Once you've decolonized and there is no more colonial framework, now you have a new playing field, and we can begin to think of one democratic state. Now here, there's a real disagreement among Palestinians what that one state would look like. I would say, and I can't represent Palestinians, but just in an impressionistic way, probably 90% or more of Palestinians accept the one state idea. I mean, this was the basis of the PLO's plan from the very beginning, and even way before the PLO. They were forced into one state. it's another whole issue, but, you know, after World War I, Palestinians really wanted to remain a part of Syria. Arab nationalism that the Palestinians were a part of is a cultural nationalism. And they didn't want states. These states were imposed by Europeans. Their idea of liberation was Arab unity, really from Morocco to Iraq. You know, that was their concept, but after World War I, with the whole partition of the region by France and Britain, they were forced into a state kind of idea. But the idea was always one democratic state that was inclusive. The disagreement is this. What do we mean by one state? Is it one Palestinian state or one civil state? The difference being, for most Palestinians, that's what I'm saying, in my view, maybe 90% of the Palestinians look at it this way. What is liberation? Liberation is liberation. Palestine becomes Palestine again. The Palestinian national rights are restored. It's called Palestine, and it becomes a Palestinian state. All right, what about the Israeli Jews? Well, in a way, who cares? I mean, if they want to stay, they can stay as equal citizens, but they will not be recognized as a national group. They'll only be recognized as individual citizens that have a certain ethnic or religious identity. But it's not a binational state in any way. It's a Palestinian state that includes, as equal citizens, non-Palestinians. Or they can leave. I mean, it's up to them. That really isn't our problem as Palestinians. So that's the concept that I think most Palestinians have. And there's two problems with it, in our view, because we're in the other camp, which is by far the minority civil state camp. One problem is that what's called settler colonial legacies. You know, settler colonialism is different than colonialism. When the British were in India, you know, when they left, they left. I mean, they were gone. They didn't settle India. Now, they didn't leave India the way it was. In terms of resources, in terms of cities, new cities, or old cities that were made huge, population movements, new crops. I mean, there were a lot of legacies after colonialism. After settler colonialism, it's even more so. You don't go back. We're not going to go back to Palestine in 1948. Almost half the population are Israeli Jews. And regardless of what people hope, they're going to stay there. Maybe it'll be 35%, maybe it'll be 45%, depends how many refugees come back. But they're going to be a major part of the population. That's what I call the demographic legacy. I mean, there's all kinds of others, economic and geographic and so on, as you can see. The other major legacy is a nationalist one. Over the last century, and certainly over the last 76 years of sovereignty as Israel, they have become a national group. They should be, they shouldn't be, whatever. That's the sociological reality. And you don't reduce a national group to an ethnic minority. That just doesn't happen. It's a recipe for conflict. And in addition to that, who of us likes nationalism? I mean, nationalism itself is destructive. It has an urge to rule, to have hegemony. It's intolerant of the people that don't belong to our national group. It's exclusivist. It's violent. Think of Orbán's Hungary, just as one of, or Modi's India, with its Hindu nationalism today. Is that really what we want for a Palestinian state? Because in that, all nationalism contains those seeds of violence and conflict. And I think in that kind of a Palestinian state, you're going to have all kinds of fighting between the two national groups, those groups and whatever civil government you try to establish. And don't forget the Islamic nationalism that feeds in as well. In other words, it's moral, it's just, the idea of a Palestinian state. But I think in terms of the actual realities, of making it work, it's not very workable, and in fact, it contains seeds of conflict. So what we're trying to suggest, the alternative, is one democratic civil state. And what it says is basically, all right, let's lay this out. You know, it's pretty straightforward. There should be let me just go back one second, sorry. It's based on the idea, you see, one Palestinian state is based on the idea of justice and international law that gives Palestinians a right of self-determination in their own state. But our approach of a civil state is based on substantial justice, not absolute justice, also international law, but it takes into account those legacies and realpolitik. In other words, is the international community, that you can't ignore, going to agree to a Palestinian state in which Israeli Jews somehow, the security is called into question, or they're not happy with their status, and maybe conflictual? In other words, we have to really look at this in a rational, political kind of a way, not only in terms of justice. Our idea of a civil state, then, says that there is a civil state of equal citizens. It dismantles settler colonialism, but it acknowledges those colonial legacies we talked about. It acknowledges that there is an Israeli national group that has to be dealt with, and it acknowledges in general the destructiveness of nationalism. So what does it mean? It means, and I'm going to finish, I know I have to, going over time, so I'll finish up. It's fairly straightforward, most of it. In other words, we're talking about one state. No tricks. You know, because there's all kinds of ideas going on. Israelis know the two-state solution is gone. So they're trying to find all kinds of clever ways of keeping Jewish supremacy, keeping the, you know, Israel intact, keeping the two-state solution kind of intact, but not with a two-state solution. So they're talking about confederations and federations and cantonization. There's one plan, I mean, this is a tiny country. There's one plan to divide the country into 36 cantons. And of course, the cantons are Jewish cantons and Arab cantons, and, you know, what prevents people from moving from one canton to another? Well, you know, each canton has its own little government, and they decide who to come. I mean, it's so crazy. You know, there's ideas of, there's all kinds of ideas out there. What we're saying is forget it. One country, one government, one constitution, one citizenship, one legal system, one parliament, a democracy. Now, why a democracy should be so outrageous to the Canadian government, I really don't quite understand. You know, it's like, the global north and the US in particular are going all over the world, certainly to Iraq, at places like that, and saying, you know, we're peddling freedom and democracy. And you've got to take it, or else. You know, and they're forcing it down everybody's throat. And the Palestinians are coming and saying, oh, hey, you know what? Yeah, we'd like some freedom and democracy. And the answer is no. You can't have it. Everybody else has to have it, or else we'll invade you. But no, you Palestinians can't have it. So, this is really the idea, a democracy that should not be, it should, for the Canadian government, be a better option than a colonial Jewish state that's an apartheid state. Okay, obviously the return of the refugees, the refugees have a right to return, and here there's a double right. The revolution of this idea is citizenship. Because under Israel, everything depends on on who you are religiously or ethnically. You know, whether you can get a job, where you can live in the country, whether you can leave the country, who you can marry. Everything has to do with are you Jewish or not Jewish, right? So this is absolutely based on equal citizenship, and that gives the refugees a double right to return. First of all, they have a right to return under international law, like all refugees do, but they're also our citizens. Just because they were driven out of the country in the Nakba doesn't mean they lost their civil status. Or even if they left, if they fled, I mean, people flee war zones, doesn't mean they lose their civil status. When people flee Kyiv and go to Poland, they don't stop being Ukrainians. So that this kind of thing says, you're already our citizens, come home. And you will get, you know, you're not going to be naturalized, nothing. You are our citizens and you have every right to come back. And you know, and we want you to come back. So there's a whole different civic logic to the one state civil idea that doesn't exist today. Of course, there's all the individual rights, you know, that we all know. But again, the hiccup or the disagreement comes over the collective rights. Again, is this a Palestinian state? In our view, as a civil state. Well, the way we put it is, as you can see, I'm sorry I'm taking this screen and not that. You know, what we're saying is people have their collective rights. We can't force people. I mean, you can't force people to have to give up their identities. You don't even like their identities. They have a right to their identities. So what we say is there are constitutional guarantees protecting national, ethnic, religious communities, our constitutional guarantees protecting national, ethnic, and religious communities, and their right to collective identities, associations, cultures, and institutions. And that's the basis of a civil democracy. And let me say one more thing about it, and then I'll read it. And that is that not only is this, I think, workable and substantially just, because, you know, within this framework, got so many things to ferment all with the press. Within this framework, this is kind of how it would look. So, you see, we have to invent a new country. You know, it's not Palestine, certainly not Israel. I don't know what we'll call it. Maybe we'll call it Palestine. Maybe we'll call it Palestine-Israel. You know, let's, just for the sake of talking about it for a second, call it Za'atar. You know, all know what Za'atar is, right? Palestinian herb. It's not exactly, it's the neutral term, but let's just use it. So we're all Za'atarians. We have to create a new state of Za'atar in which we're all citizens, we're all Za'atarians. That means then a new civic state of equal rights, a government, a constitution of citizens. Well, that's going to be very weak. And that's always been the problem in the post-colonial world, especially in Africa, where the civil states were not as strong as the national, tribal, religious groups that were contained within them. And they didn't last very long. And that's, this problem that we're trying to get at, to avoid that. So that the idea is a civic state, and there would be this civic space, this white space. And the people that would join it, you know, what we have to understand, I think, in this view, and I think it's true, is we can't reduce everything to sectarian. You know, not everybody is Palestinian or Israeli Jewish. There's all kinds of cross-cutting sorts of things. Middle-class people, middle-class Palestinians, will find much more in common in terms of their education and their professions and their lifestyles than they'll find with Palestinian farmers. You know, business people will work together. You know, one of the main forces for the collapse of apartheid in South Africa was the business community. that said, you know, it's not good for business that one population is highly educated and the workers aren't, because we need skilled workers. You know, equality is better for business than apartheid. And they were one of the main forces for the fall of apartheid. The younger generation. You know, the bad thing about the younger generation, if I can say as an old man, is that they forget. You know, that's why we have museums. That's why they forget pretty quickly. I was in South Africa years ago, and the anti-apartheid activists had a whole program to teach young South Africans about apartheid. Because Mandela for them was some distant ancient figure, you know? So they forget quickly. The good thing about young people is the same thing. They get on with their lives. They get on with their lives. And this kind of, you know, my fear of a Palestinian state, you know, it's an ethno-state, it's a nation-state, locks everybody into this sectarian, that you've got to be Palestinian now or you're not Palestinian, or, you know, it perpetuates that whole kind of these sectarian splits. This frees you. Certainly you're Palestinian, let's say. You know, you're Palestinian. And you have, if you want, you can be as Palestinian as you want to. If you want to go to the mosque or not, if you want to participate in Palestinian cultural life or not, live with Palestinians, you know, you decide how much you want to be in the community or within the, but you have a choice of this wider civil society. So people can, if they don't want to, they can intermarry. They can go live, you know, they can live without any relationship to their national identities. You're freeing a new civil society to emerge. That it's hard to emerge in the first option, but nevertheless you do have meaningful cultural space. There is a cultural, in other words, the trick is, you know, the nationalism we talked about, which is destructive and hegemonous, and one is, you know, wants to have rule over the other, is what we call political nationalism. But what we're talking about is a cultural nationalism, which is much more in tune with Arab nationalism. That was always cultural. So that we're talking about, you can live a meaningful Palestinian life and a meaningful Jewish life. Even in Israeli national Jewish life, you can live, you'll have museums, you'll have universities, you'll have your literature, you'll have every kind of expression that you want, but within the framework of the civil state. That's the point. So that some populations will want to be in that cultural mode. Refugees coming back, they have no idea what civil society means. They've never experienced that. They want to come home to Palestine. So for a generation or two or whatever, they'll want to remain kind of within the Palestinian sphere, which is fine, even though they're equal citizens, and they'll learn how to vote and how, but initially they want to be in that. Ultra-Orthodox Jews are going to want to stay within the Jewish thing. They're not going to be a part of civil society. So it accommodates populations that want to be here or there. So that's kind of the vision of the one state that we're talking about. At any rate, whether it's, you know, whatever form it takes, I think one state is the only kind of political solution that offers substantial justice, hope to people, the emergence of a real society that everybody can participate in, integration into the region, and a real end to the settler colonial project. So I'll end it on that. Sorry, I went over.